Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. This is Professor Gary Lee with the AMAA blog. Dr. Jeff Bowen, are you there, sir?
Yes, sir, I am here. How are you guys doing today?
Doing great, Mr.
Yeah, you're sort of cutting out there a little bit, sir.
I am cutting out?
Yeah, that sounds a little bit better now. I'm ready for a good show. I know you got a great guest on tonight.
Yes.
Yes, sir, you are cutting out. We can't hear
okay.
you.
You want me to try to call back?
Sure. Well, you sound okay right now. Let's try it a couple more times and see what happens.
Okay, very good. I was asking, has Mr. Corley called in yet?
Yeah, I think he's on the line.
Yes, I am here.
Hi, Mr. Corley. Welcome to the show.
Greetings.
Yes, sir. Give me just a few minutes, and I'm going to bring you on officially. Welcome to the show, and I'll bring you on in just a moment. Okay, Mr. Corley?
That sounds great.
Thank you, sir. Welcome, everybody, to the AMAA Masters Radio Network. We took a week off last week from the honor of respected Master Junior Reese's funeral, but we're welcome. We're excited to be back in your homes on a Tuesday evening again. This is our second year to produce this show, and tonight we have a very, very special show with a very, very special guest. And we've made this show a two-hour show tonight because we've got quite a few things to cover, but particularly the 50th anniversary of the Battle of Atlanta. This is an incredible event that's been going on for 50 years, and we're going to be able to talk about that. And we actually have the founder with on the show tonight. And to make a very personal introduction, you know, one of the memories I had coming to America, you know, or to the mainland, is the early 1970s was meeting, you know, Mr. Sam Chapman. You know, I lived in this basement underneath the stairs of the karate school of Greenville, and it was a time that karate was different, and it was also the only school in the city. You know, I got to hang out with some incredible people, incredible martial artists in America, and, you know, they were just incredible, incredible people. You know, Sam, he was like a father to me, but there was one other man that I really looked up to and never realized the journey he was going to go on. But, you know, he was an original history general. We put together the museum, you know, and he believes in the work that we've done for 20 years. And he's guided me personally for those 20 years for the history, one warrior at a time. You know, Mr. Joe Corley is a rare and very unique martial artist. And this will be a rare and personal interview with the inventor and creator of the Battle of Atlanta. You know, however, Mr. Corey may not be known as he may be known as a super producer, and he is. But I remember him, and also I remember him as a karate fighter. They helped introduce the world of full contact karate in America. You know, and through his guidance to the PKA, his amazing commentary work on ESPN and the Superstation, you know, as the announcer, and of course, his two legendary fights with the Superfoot, the one only Bill Wallace. You know, we will share the old days that he had for America. The karate that basically, you know, his 50 years of producing one of the largest karate tournaments in the world, the Battle of Atlanta. You know, the personal friends are the living legends of the sport. And we will talk about what is planned for the 50th anniversary of this very important tournament in America. And how important is the prestigious and elite Joe Louis External Warrior Award? Who were the first recipient? And who will be honored this year? And why is the last year to be given out this honor? Why he chose this to be the last year? Mr. Joe Corey is one of those history generals who didn't just create the dream, but lived the dream. He shared it and nourished the history of American martial arts, you know, and karate. You know, it's an amazing to be along for his ride in the history books. Ladies and gentlemen, my mentor, the one and only, Mr. Joe Corley. Mr. Corley, are you there, sir?
Well, I'm going to have to listen in on this guy. He sounds like he's really something.
Well, he is special. You know, he always stands behind the curtain for everybody else, but it's this time I'm going to put him out in front of the curtain.
That's awfully nice.
Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. It's fun working on this event because it's like you say, it's been going on for so long, and we really look forward on this June 15th and 16th to having some great people in from all over the world. People who have been involved with us through the Battle of Atlanta as well as the PKA. So we figured there's been 50 years of the battle and 44 years of the PKA. So you got basically 94 years of good people to have worked with. And it's going to be great to get together with as many of those as can come in for it.
Well, you know, I want to go back a little bit further. I want to go back and you were thanks to those fighters. You know, people don't remember that, you know, but I constantly put people's knowledge. So let's go back to who influenced you and how did you get started, and what year did you make black belt?
Well, I earned my black belt in December of 1966. I had started in 63, and I had worked out pretty hard that whole time, other than for 3 months that I went and played baseball. And then I had really started the martial arts because I had been I was an Army brat, and my dad had taught me how to do some basic boxing when I was, 6 and 7 years old. And we would move from one Army base to another one, as he was stationed in Austria and then Germany. And he told me that the big kids would come to greet me and welcome me to the neighborhood, and it would be okay they were greeting me if I punched them in the face, and that we would be friends. So my dad passed away when I was 10, and I went back to this military school that he had enrolled me in the first grade. I went back in the fifth grade. And half of my classmates in the military school had been sent there for a military education. The other half had been sent there because their parents couldn't stand having them at home. So those were kind of like the kids that my dad had told me about. And so I ended up doing a lot of fighting when I was there at the military school. And about the time I was 16, I realized that grown men were fighting a lot more viciously than kids were, and I better learn something because I wasn't going to be a huge person. So I heard that I could go down to this class and learn how to break some bricks, and I figured if I could break some bricks, I could, defend myself pretty well. But after the very first class, I was there with an American named Bob Dye and a Korean named Kim Dashik, and I left there that night thinking that I had found a home.
Wow. Okay. How old were you, though? How old were you again?
I was 16 at the time.
Now, when do you get the fever for first sport karate event?
Well, you know, when I was a green belt, I entered my first tournament, and I ended up doing a jump sidekick into someone's face and broke his nose, and I got disqualified. But for some reason, they gave me the sportsmanship award for the tournament. I guess because I had been, properly sad for doing it, but I gave the award to the person whose nose I had broken because I actually thought he was a much better sport than I was. But I really loved that feeling of competition right away. And so as soon as I became brown belt, I started traveling. I won the Georgia brown belt title and the Alabama brown belt title. But everything was, close by. And then won 3 Southeast U.S. titles as a black belt. But I was watching Chuck Norris and Alan Steen and Joe Lewis from the Internationals. I was watching some old Super 8 films in the darkness of the studio, and I watched them over and over. I think I wore the films out, and that gave me the inspiration to want to travel outside of the Southeast. And so I went up to Henry Cho's tournament at the Garden for my first time out of the Southeast, and actually ended up being able to meet Chuck at that event. And he invited me out to train in California, and I thought that was pretty special. It was only later that I would learn that he would invite everybody up, but nevertheless, you know, I felt pretty good about that. And it would be a few years before I could get out there to train with him, but that that really was the place where my creative and sport interest came to play. I fought a guy up there in New York named Hawk Frazier. And I won the fight, and then they called it back, and then we fought again, and then he won, and then he went on to fight Chuck Norris for the grand championship that night. But you know, I had a good taste for it.
Wow, you know that's really a cool story. Now, you know. You fought a lot, and I followed your career, and I've gone deep because, you know me, I'm a journalist. I've done deep, and I found some incredible pictures. And one particular picture I found was you fighting John Natividad, who's one of my Hawaiian heroes, who's also, understand, getting one of the Joe Louis Atuna Awards this year. Do you remember that fight with Mr. Natividad?
Yeah. Like so many of the guys from the Norris crew, he just outsmarted me in this fight and won it fair and square. But I remember the picture you found. It was great. I was doing a jump spinning back kick at him.
Wow.
That was a good
now
shot.
Now I've got another picture. Like, I'm sorry. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, that wasn't me.
I'm sorry. Well, I've got another picture. You know, share my listeners with this picture. It's one picture where you're doing a beautiful kick, and then another picture of the guy's laying on the ground knocked out. When was that?
Yeah, those
Where
were two. Well, those were two different fights, but I just thought they'd make a good pair. The kick was at Jim Miller's tournament down in New Orleans, and I ended up facing Wallace for the grand championship fight that night. But the other one was a fight in Chattanooga, and that's another reason I put them together, because I was one fight away from fighting Bill and for the grand championship in Chattanooga, but that was the guy was a brown belt when I was brown belt, and he was a little bit of he was kind of a talker, you know. He would, when you weren't there, he would talk badly about you, and so I made the mistake. In fact, Karate Illustrated wrote an article one time, said, Born Again for Togetherness was the title of it. And it talked about how I had gone into his gym one night with a contract that I had drawn up by an attorney that said we could just do a good old-fashioned fight, and we would hold each other harmless. And he didn't think that was a good idea, and then began to tell people that I was, you know, maybe a little off. And so... 3 years later, there we were fighting in this tournament in Chattanooga, and we were about a minute into the match, and I was up 3-0, and he stuck his chin out and tapped it. And I know Sam Chapman was there that night. I love to hear him tell the story. He tells it pretty well. But I remember one of my students, who's now one of our great orthopedic doctors, and he'll be with us at the Joe Louis Award. But he looked at another one of our students. He says, "I don't think that was a good idea that the guy would stick his chin out like that." So he rushed in and reached out to grab my uniform to punch me, and I guess he ran into my punch on the way in, and he was wearing glasses, and so the glasses. The frame lens, I should say, came out of the frame and cut his eye, and it was headed up towards the rafters in the gym, and he fell immediately to the floor, and the place got deathly quiet, and we could hear this lens going whew, 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 up towards the ceiling, and then it came down and went ding 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 like that on the floor, And Daniel Pye was the referee, and I looked down at this guy, and he looked up at me through his one good eye and said, "I wasn't going to hurt you." And I said, "Well, thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that."
That's
the answer to the question about why he was lying on the floor.
Yes, that's a great story. You know, you had the vision with a few of your friends, Mr. Sam Chapman, Bill McNeese, Mr. Jerry Pivington, I believe Chris McLaughlin was part of that, and they formed a group called SECA, the Southeastern Karate Association. Tell me a little bit about that vision, and what was that about?
Well, we would, a lot of us, travel around into other parts of the country, and we found there was a lot of regional bias. And only a few people, you know, and they were really people like Joe Lewis and Jeff Smith and Bill Wallace, could travel to any other area and beat almost anybody there because they were so much better than everybody else. But those of us that were on that second tier of competition would almost always find that the officiating didn't go in our favor, even if we were doing well. And so we decided we wanted to create a tournament that was fair, and so we set up the Southeast U.S. Championship in 1970, and I flew out to L.A. and invited Joe Lewis to come in for it, and then the people that we knew on the Korean circuit, Mitchell Bobro and Joe Hayes and all those people from that area came in. Glenn Keeney and Bill Wallace came in for the first one. So we had 23 black belts in that first tournament, and 15 of them were, you know, all top level black belts at the time, got good write ups in the magazines and all that. And it was just a wonderful event. Joe Lewis won it. Joe Hayes won the lightweight division. I actually fought in that first tournament because we had a Korean working for us at the time, and we had him as the promoter. So I lost to Joe Hayes, and then Mitchell Bobro lost to Joe Lewis. And so it was Joe Lewis and Joe Hayes fighting for the grand championship. And of course, Joe Lewis won it. So he won $1,019.70. I don't know what that would be worth now. Maybe a million, I guess. So it really created an atmosphere of being a fighter's tournament. But when the writer that wrote the story wrote it for Black Belt Magazine, they called it the Battle of Atlanta. And so then we started using that name from then on.
Very well. Great answer. That's incredible, that history. So the Battle of Atlanta started with the vision of that one tournament. Now, what happened, and I'm asking you this because my show is called Parts Unknown, so I'm going to dig a little deep. What happened one night when you decided to take it deeper and just, because what you've done, you know, and for my listeners who maybe listen for the first time, Mr. Corley has taken the historian word of sport karate on a steroid level. He was my mentor, all the work I've done for 20 years. So I'm really excited about asking you this question. When did you see the vision of the Battle of Atlanta when you realized it was going to be something really, very, very special? And you had all your friends who were either, you know, the great karate fighters or the movie stars or the celebrities of the art to come and support you. When did you see that vision?
Well, you know, until you asked me that question the other night, I had never really thought about it like that. But in answering the question, I realized myself that in 1970, 71, and 72, we held the tournament in the field house at Oglethorpe Coliseum. And in 72, Chuck Norris was kind enough to come out for it. And it was, you know, predated his great film successes. But he was still well known in the martial arts community because, as you recall, those were the days when the magazines were really writing about the champions, and so the champions had a great following inside the community. And then in 73, we arranged to bring out not only Chuck Norris, but Pat Johnson came, and Bob Wall came, and Mike Stone, and Tadashi Yamashita, and then Mike Foster came up from Florida. And they were our chief officials. And we moved to the Georgia Tech Coliseum, which was going to be expensive, and we had been advertising inside the Kung Fu series for our karate studios, and I had a Ferrari at the time. It was a 1967 GTB4, which was a 12-cylinder, 6.2 barrel thing. It was the most fun thing I ever had or drove in my life, and I sold it. And I had bought it 3 years earlier for $9,000 at a time when I'd bought a new Corvette for $2,800. So it was about four times the price of a Corvette. But I sold it for the same amount that I paid for it. And we did that to finance the 1973 Battle of Atlanta. And I had been working with a disc jockey here in Atlanta named Gary McKee, who was making $1 million a year, you know, in the 80s as a morning drive disc jockey, which I guess would be worth, you know, $5 million now. But he was taking private lessons with me, and I told him that Heidi Ochai was coming in, and we'd love to have, you know, since he made his living with his voice, we'd love to have Heidi Ochai cut a, what was he would going to cut off his throat? I think it was a pickle or something, you know, off his throat. So, and he was going to do that blindfolded. So Gary McKee agreed to do that. We challenged him on the radio to do it. And then we ran the ads inside the Kung Fu series. And so when all of us, the officials, the chief officials, went back in the room to talk about the finals that night, we were really surprised when we came out and saw this Georgia Tech Coliseum just full of people. We had about 6,500 wow. people sitting in the audience. And then we had the Tournament of Champions is what they had come to see. And that had been the brainchild of Pat Johnson, who had the idea that many martial artists would not come and compete in a tournament if they knew they were going to have to fight the very best ones in the eliminations, that they'd feel much better fighting themselves. And then if they did had a great day, then they could go into a round of champions. And then if they lost to those champions, that wouldn't be any, you know, any loss of face like it would have been if they had lost to him in the eliminations. So his plan was just exactly right. And so we had Bill Wallace, and we had Jeff Smith and Howard Jackson, and, you know, Glenn Keeney and Ken Knudsen and all kinds of great people there, you know, in the Tournament of Champions, Fred Wren. And so Howard Jackson ended up winning in a fight against Jeff Smith. But it was that night that we felt that what we were doing might have a broader appeal than we had thought it would have before.
Wow, that really explains my question. You know, before we go into the heart of the battle this year and what you got planned for all of us, I want to say something to the listeners, and it's the heart of Joe Corey, and I'm going to tell a story that maybe I don't think I've ever shared it with you, but I want to share it with you. It was 2006, and the second time ever NASCA to come to Texas. The first time was Mr. Garza in 1993, but Mr. Beasley brought it to Austin, Texas, and I went to the tournament, and my son competed, and he did really good that day in kata. And I remember you coming up to me, and you asked me if he would like to go through the battle. And of course, that time, you know, I was, well, really hard. It was hard times, you know. And you just looked at my heart and said, "Don't worry about it, Gary. I'll take care of it." And Gary went through the battle that year in 2006, and I appreciate that so much. And I know that you've done that for a few people, and people don't understand that you're known as this producer, you're known as this fighter, but then you got this heart of a tremendous passion of giving. And, you know, people who are passionate, they always give it to other people and help other people. And, you know, I wanted to share that with my listeners and with you personally, but you're very special on that level. That tournament, the Battle of Atlanta, changed my son's attitude in karate. And
wow,
not only winning it, but it was just an amazing time. And your heart, Mr. Corley. So, you know, you're not just a producer, not just a great fighter, but you've got heart. You can't, you know, that's something you can't. You're just really an incredible person. So let's talk about.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. That's nice.
Yes, sir. Well, let's talk about June 15th and 16th. First of all, I got layers. And before, you know, I'm not worried about my break. I want to talk about the layers. The first layer I want to talk about is that you've got 3 days planned, correct? Can you tell me about some of the things you planned for those 3 days besides the Joe Lewis Award and the competition, of course?
Well, my focus is just on Friday primarily. As you know, we sold the Battle of Atlanta to a good man, Greg Ruth, back in 2013. And so for the last 5 years, he has done a great job running and coordinating, and his sons, Toby and Tommy Ruth. So their initials would be T. Ruth. So his company is called Truth Entertainment. And they've just done a really nice job in the way they profile the tournament. In the Martial Arts Success Magazine interview that we just recently did with you know, Centuries Magazine, I explained that I had seen Greg Ruth make all the right decisions for the right reasons and the right principles. And as you said, he had that same kind of heart, always kind of putting the, you know, the competitors first. And so he was into effectiveness and not necessarily efficiency. And so the tournament just runs great. You know, it's still a NASCA 5A rated event. And so my job, what I decided to do, what would make me happy this year would be if we took all the great people that we could reach out to and find over these last 50 battles of Atlanta, 49 battles of Atlanta, and the great champions from the PKA. And if we could get as many of those people in the same room at the same time as possible, that we could create what Stephen Covey calls synergy, you know, where something magical could actually happen there. And so I've been really energized working on that. So the answer to your question is, on Friday at 1 o'clock, we're going to have people come into a room, and they will be they'll be saying hi and telling war stories and taking selfies, as Dan Anderson said. And then we're going to have some camera people there who are going to go around and record some of these stories, so we'll have them for posterity. And then our friend George Chung, you know, who won so many Battle of Atlantas and national tournaments, and is actually the one that you can blame for all the forms competitors coming up and saying, with your permission, may I begin. he started that way back when, and just makes you want to say, no, you don't have my permission. But he's coming in with his new 24/7 martial arts channel, and he's going to be interviewing a lot of these great fighters and great leaders from all these years, and try to package it in a kind of an HBO-style format, something that we'll have to look back on that we can, you know, because like Grandmaster Bowen says in his book, you know, many of the people that he's written about there have lost their chance to tell their stories. And so with that theme, we would like to make sure that these stories and these people can be seen and recognized. And they are just excited as they can be to come and hang with people like this. You know, it always reminds me of the phrase, or when the men were men and the women were proud of it. You know, there's going to be some great synergy in the room.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Now, you've also done something very special. You've created and surrounded it not only with the incredible an award that's recognized by one of the greatest fighters that ever lived, and that's, of course, your personal friend, Mr. Joe Lewis. Before we talk about that award, what was your personal relationship with Mr. Lewis, Mr. Court?
You know, you ask such great questions.
Thank
when,
you, sir. You taught me well.
When I would watch Lewis fight, and when I would watch Lewis come into a room, I'll give you an example of the very first Battle of Atlanta. Joe Lewis and Bill Wallace went over on the side. You know, one was a heavyweight, one was a, you know, lightweight. We only had two weight divisions at that time. They went over, and I watched something that I had not seen before. When when the whole place just stopped and they paid attention to what these two guys were doing over there, and on the side, I mean, I can still see the image in my mind's eye inside that Oglethorpe Fieldhouse. And then if you fast forward a few years to when Joe Louis came up on the stage in the Los Angeles Sports Arena in that first PKA World Championships that was broadcast on you know, ABC's Wide World of Entertainment, he just came in the ring and it was kind of like when Mike Tyson would come into the ring and he had all these belts on his chest, and then you could just see that he owned that ring that he just got into. That was his ring. He owned it. And then
yes, sir.
Over these next few years, as we got involved in the television part of it, we began to recognize and be able to quantify and actually describe something called charisma. And as I said, when we did the video for Joe Louis when he was diagnosed with the brain cancer and we were all sending our prayers his way, he had this incredible talent and he had just the right dose of crazy, you know. So when I would talk to him, I would always think about, and every time I'd see this guy with Johnny Carson, there was an actor named Robert Blake. The two of them had the same mannerisms and all that, and they were both just crazy as road lizards. You know, I mean, Joe Louis would talk about his life, and he would talk about how his father, you know, chased him out into the woods and tried to stab him with a butcher knife, and that most of his brothers had gone to prison. And then I knew that he had gone to Vietnam, and it would be only later at his funeral service where I would get a chance to meet Walter Anderson, who had been his lifetime friend, who would tell these great stories about Joe. And he would say that people would ask Joe a question, and he was so quiet and so shy that, you know, Walter would have to answer the questions for him. So at the very least, Joe was a very, very complicated character. He was probably as handsome as anybody that's ever walked the planet. He was as fierce as any fighter we had ever seen, and he was funny, and he was shy, and he was all these things. I mean, he was just a mixture of all these things. So he and I never really got close, you know, we teased each other more than anything, but I guess from his perspective, he probably didn't trust a whole lot of people. And go ahead.
Yes, sir. No, I just wanted to say that I've got my favorite Joe Louis story, and I wanted to share it with you. But go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt. I get excited talking to you, Mr. Corday. I apologize.
No, that's great. But anyway, I went out and I watched him fight in the first PKA World Championships, and you know, we went to watch full contact karate, but it really turned into PKA kickboxing just because Joe Louis was the only one that could really box at the time, and so all of us then. I mean, I had already been in the boxing gym preparing for another fight, but. Everybody then started learning how to box, and it ultimately over time wasn't full contact karate. It was really kickboxing. But Joe fought, and you know, he ended up losing to Ross Scott just before he was going to get in the ring with Kareem Allah and fight on that thrill in Manila. And Jeff ended up taking his place when he got his shoulder dislocated in his fight with Ross Scott. All of these are going to be just great stories as we record them here at the Battle of Atlanta. So anyway, I saw that happen, and I saw him not take advantage of all of his charisma in Hollywood, and he burned some bridges there. And so at June Rhee's 80th birthday, let me take one or second. When he decided he wanted to come back into the ring, we decide to have him come back into the ring at the Battle of Atlanta and then start promoting his return on ESPN. And it just captured the imagination of the country again. He was 39, almost 40 years old, and he got back. And, you know, I did everything I could to help promote him, and then he finally ended up losing against Kerry Roop as he got cut in a fight with Kerry. And then fast forward then, he comes to the Battle of Atlanta. He's friends with Jay Will. He comes and, you know, he's traveling the country. He's doing seminars and so forth. And then you fast forward to June Rhee's 80th birthday in 2011 in the Capitol Rotunda. And Gary, I had started writing a book in 1999, and it was now 2010, and I had gotten all of three paragraphs done. I'd started the book with a quote from Harry Chapin, who said, "Sometimes words can serve me well, and sometimes words can go to hell for all that they do." And so I got that written in two more paragraphs, and then I was stuck. So 11 years later, I had three paragraphs written of this book. And here's Joe Louis in the Capitol Rotunda. The senators and the congressmen are all there, up there talking about June Rhee. And he pops down. He does 100 push-ups in 60 seconds. And you look over at the table, and Joe Louis is sitting there holding court, having everybody squeeze this hand thing, you know, to develop your wrist strength. He was always important about how – it was always important to him about how strong your hands were. So even though it was June Rhee's birthday, he was still commanding center stage. So we all walked down in the rain that night down to the Hyatt, the Capitol Hyatt, and sitting at the table, I think, are Alan Steen and Skipper Mullins and a bunch of these people. And so Joe Louis still had these knuckles, you know, these big callous knuckles on his hand. And he is just, he's holding court, and he's just, he's moving his hands almost like a conductor would in an orchestra. And he just looks at me out of the blue and he says, "Corley, do you know how bad I screwed up?" And I said, yeah, I do. I really do. And he went ahead, he kept talking. And after about 5 minutes, he looked at me, said, "I never really thought you liked me." I said, "Yeah, I really did." And so the night went on, you know, we all went our separate ways. The next day I wrote 10 chapters.
Wow. Well, you know, I've got to tell you my absolute best story about Mr. Joe Louis. And it's 1995, yeah. The Super Grands at Savannah, Georgia. And I'm hanging out with Black Belt TV. That's, you know, I helped do that in the 90s. And we were doing commercials. And I was hanging out with Mr. Glenn Keeney, Mike Anderson, and Mr. Anderson was introducing the new top 10 equipment that's made out of leather. And he was talking about it was going to change the industry, whatever. So anyway, Mr. Keeney says, well, you know, and Mr. Wallace was there too, by the way. And Mr. Keeney was talking about, well, it doesn't really matter if you have the equipment on. It's about how you kick and where you kick. And anyway, the conversation got started talking about a spin back kick, a jump spin back kick particularly. And you know Mr. Wallace, because he's your best friend, he was really agging it on, okay, really agging it. And Mr. Lewis heard the conversation, so he comes walking over. And next thing I knew, Mr. Keeney says, well, listen, let me see this thing. I need a volunteer, though. Of course, I raised my hand up. And Mr. Keeney took off his right foot and put on that new top 10 foot, which is made out of leather, the new one, the blue one. And he said, Gary, are you ready? I said, yes, sir. And I thought, you know, I might get kicked. But Mr. Keeney did this perfect jump, spin, back kick, and it was perfect, Mr. Corley. And he just barely touched my nose, okay? Dropped down.
Wow.
And then, of course, Mr. Wallace was just agging it on, just really agging on. And Mr. Louis just said, well, listen, you know, that's pretty good, but I'll do it with my left leg. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, he's going to kick me. I know he's going to kick me. But anyway, he's picked up his foot. And he keeps his other shoe on, but puts a foot on his left foot. And he didn't tell me, are you ready, Gary, or anything like that. He just looks at me, and boom, bam! I mean, he hits me. If it wasn't for me going, yeah, T.I.ing, he knocked me against the wall. And, of course, he just looked at me and said, okay, like that. And it was I expected that. but he didn't pull it. He didn't pull it, Mr. Corley. He nailed me. If I had one prepared for it, it would have knocked the wind out of me. It would have really nailed
me. I can just see a sly grin on his face right now. Just looking at you, I can just see that in my mind's eye.
Story, Mr. Corley, is about 10 minutes later, I had to do a bunch of commercials, and I had no place to put Garrett. Garrett was like 8 years old, and Mr. Corley, I promise you, he goes, Gary, he can stay with me. And Garrett stayed with Mr. Lewis with him, and I left for almost an hour and a half. When I came back, Garrett was on Mr. Lewis's knee, and they were just having a good time. And the next morning, he bought breakfast for Garrett and I and just gave me a bunch of stuff for the museum. I got to see another part of Mr. Lewis that a lot of people don't get to see, the one that you just talked about. So, but leading tell me about this award and how important it is for sport karate. I know it's probably the most important award to be given out, but tell me how it was developed and the vision of it.
Well, like I say, whatever Joe Lewis said and did that night inspired me to write 10 chapters. When he was diagnosed with the brain cancer, we arranged at the Battle of Atlanta. I had written that video, and then Mark Graydon had put the pictures together with it. And it was really a moving and inspiring piece. I still wish it had, helped heal him. But we, at the 2012 Battle of Atlanta, then we had everybody come up on the stage and watch it. And we were feeding the signal to Joe's hospital room in Philadelphia. And somebody on the other end up there screwed it up, and he didn't get to see it at the time. But I realized as I was putting that copy together and recording it that he had actually been closer to me than we had been to each other. And so when he passed away and we went to the funeral up there in North Carolina, it just tore me up.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Well,
and
this,
then
this award is
when
considered.
I ended up writing about that for, I was just going to say, Gary, I just ended up writing about that for Official Karate Magazine, and at the time I had never written anything emotional like that.
Yes,
and then the next year, we were going to commemorate Joe's winning the first Battle of Atlanta. And so Jeff Smith and I brainstormed about it. And I had written for Official Karate Magazine, my article had been called One More Round. And it was based on Gentleman Jim Corbett's poem that he had written back in professional boxing when you get knocked down, the round would be over, kind of like our first title fight that Bill Wallace had with me, where if you got knocked down, you go back to the corner. But in boxing in those days, you just keep going until one guy couldn't continue or he was knocked out. And so some of the fights would go as many as 50 or 60 rounds. And so Jim Corbett had written this poem. And Jim Corbett was known as the father of American boxing. And so the more you dug into Jim Corbett, you realized he was an actor as well. He was a motion picture actor, like Joe had been. And he had invented the left hook. And then you think about, all the things that Joe Lewis had incorporated in the fighting. And so just that well of emotion that had been in the from his funeral came out, and we were able to create this award and get it approved by Joe Lewis Fighting Systems. And then his daughter, Christina, came in, a beautiful woman came in and stood with Jeff Smith and Bill Wallace. And they were the first two to receive the award, along with Chuck Norris. And then she and Bill and Jeff then presented all the awards to the other people. And so they did the nominations this time. 5 years later, I think we've only got 25 people that have received it up until this time. And so anyway, that's the genesis of the war, the emotion. It's hard for me to talk about it without tearing up. But
well, I don't mean to make you cry.
That's it.
And I appreciate the time to share with me. I know it means a lot to you. And I know you don't do interviews anymore. But one more thing before we talk a little more about the battle on Friday night. You had an incredible career as a commentator. And honestly, I blame you and Mr. Minshew for even me doing the work I do. Both of you guys really, really were my mentors. But that's a really interesting story in the pre-interview that you tell me about how you met Mr. Ted Turner and the Superstation start to go involved with the ESPN. You know, I'd like for you to explain that to my listeners because it's very interesting. Can you share that with me, please?
Yeah, kind of the way the backdrop that I gave you on that is that every morning when I can, I do this ritual that Tony Robbins creates. And in the ritual, he talks about how you want to go back and in your memory, focus on something that was could have been considered a lucky break or something that was serendipitous that could have happened that caused good things to happen for you. And I had explained to you that I used to go into WTBS, which was not TBS, it was WTCG, were the call letters of the original superstation. And at the time, it was in less than a million homes around the country. And I knew that Ted Turner had, he had gone to the same military school that I referenced earlier. I think he had made it there for just 1 year before he had washed out. And of course, he was a few years ahead of me. But anyway, I would go to the superstation about every 3 months. I would make a presentation to a guy named Sid Pike, who was the program director for WTCG. And Sid was an interesting guy who had absolutely zero emotion. He would look at you and just with a blank stare. He wouldn't nod. He wouldn't acknowledge anything that you said. And then you'd finish your presentation, and he would say, "We're not interested." And that was the end of the conversation. So, after about my fourth or fifth try there, over 12 to 15 months, I was leaving the meeting, and as I walked down the hall, Ted Turner was there, and he had a saber in his hand, a saber like we had as officers at the military school. And he was,
right.
He saw me and he said, "Karate guy, what would you do against this sword?" And I looked at him and I got into a fighting stance. And I said, "Well, if you knew how to use it, I'd probably run away. But I think I'm just going to beat you to death." And so I started moving at him and he started backing down the hall and swinging that saber in an X-like fashion, at me and just moving backwards and moving backwards. And then after about three steps, he stopped. He said, wait, I got it. And then he called every executive in the building. He was in a small building then, of maybe, 2,500 square feet of office space. And so he called all the executives into the office, and he said, "So you're the little guy in sports, right? I mean, with your kickboxing and all." And I said, "Yep, that's right." He said, "You need the superstation, right?" And I said, "That's right." He said, "Would you go to Washington and testify for us? Norman Lear is trying to shut the superstation down, the producer for All in the Family, and he doesn't want us to be able to send our signal out into these cities." I said, "Yes, sir. We'll do that for you." He said, "Good. What can I do for you?" I said, "Well, we're going to have a heavyweight title fight in the Omni. It's going to be Jerry Rome against Ross Scott, and we would like to have it air on the superstation." He says, "It's done." And Sid Pike says, "Yeah, but Ted." And he said, "No, not but Ted anything. Sid, we're doing it." So we go and we do that. Larry Black works with Bob Neal. They do a great job calling the action. Jerry Rome and Ross Scott put on one hell of a fight. And it's great. We got the finished product that airs on the superstation in a million homes or so. And then I take that video and decide I'm going to go to New York. So I go knocking on the door at CBS. And they say, "Well, we really don't air anybody else's stuff. But I tell you what, we're doing a Bill Wallace fight in Las Vegas next month. and I'd like you to be our commentator, our play-by-play guy. And I said, well, you know, what had happened in the meantime is Bill and I had fought in 75. We're now talking about 1977. And the Quines didn't like me, and I certainly didn't like them. And I said to the producer, I said, well, the Quines certainly aren't going to let me be involved in their production. He said, well, it'll be like this. They either say yes or we don't do the event. I said, well, I like that. So he told them that I was going to do it. And they didn't have any choice but to say okay. And so I went out and I did the event with Gary Bender, and CBS liked what we did. And that's when I got with the Quines, and we agreed to then try to promote the sport together. And then after that, I should have been awarded at least 100 Purple Hearts for the agony that I went through in those next from 1977 to 1985 when they violated the shareholders agreement. But anyway, that's the way the television started. And then so I did that live. We did a live Wallace event every 3 months for a good while. And then Sean McManus, who now runs CBS Sports, was over at NBC at the time. And he was the son of Jim McKay, who was the voice, you know, of the Olympics over at ABC and on Wide World of Sports. And so he did some fights at NBC, and we got some of the highest ratings that NBC had ever had on Sports World. So we got to do the commentary on those things on NBC and CBS. And then, of course, later on Showtime. But then our agency was for television was IMG, which was the company that sold the UFC for $4.2 billion. And so Dana White got my $382 million in that sale. So I think I need to go and collect that now. But at any rate, that's how I got into the television part. But then when ESPN came on board, they hired Chet Simmons, who had been with Roon Arledge over at ABC's Wide World of Sports, and he was actually there when Bob Arum and Aaron Banks had put on the World Series of Martial Arts up there when Joe Hess knocked out the girl and the people catching bullets in their teeth, which, you know, kind of kept us off ABC forever. But they asked him to come over and run ESPN. So the first week that ESPN was on, our agent, IMG, made a deal for us to be on ESPN, and then we did 44 events that first year, and I did the commentary on all those, and then did the commentary on all of them all the way up through around 84 when we brought John Worley in to start doing them. So I got about 1,000 hours of programming experience doing that. But it was all because of that thing with Ted Turner. Because if that hadn't happened, then all the rest of it wouldn't have happened. So,
right.
It's amazing how little thing like that changes the world.
Yes, sir. Being parts unknown, I got to ask you, because you fought him twice. And I'm talking about Mr. Wallace. You know, his record was 23-0. And the question I want to ask, and I pretty much know the answer, but I want to hear it from you since you fought him twice. How good was Bill Wallace? How good was
it? You know, I don't think anybody would ever know, because I think whatever you put in front of him, he would rise to that occasion. He is. I mean, just smart like you wouldn't believe. And he has instincts. He and Jeff Smith and Joe Louis, people would always ask the question, you know, some people kind of infer from the fact that we all hang around together that we must be in the same category. And I have to remind people that those guys were breathing air that none of the rest of us ever got a chance to breathe. I say none of the others there. There were a few that did. I mean, Mike Warren and, Mitchell Bobrow was a lot better than anybody ever knew. there were guys like that, but those three guys, Wallace, Smith, and Joe Lewis, were at altitudes that most of us never got to. So I was, you know, I might have been down in the, you know, 2 or 3 percentage points below them, but kind of like, you know, if a horse wins a Kentucky Derby by a nose, you know, what the difference is in that guy and the other one. So, but those three guys could do it all. When Wallace and I, when I watched Wallace fight in 74 in the World Championships, I had already been in the boxing gym for a good 6 months, and I knew that there wasn't anything he could do to hit me in the head to hurt me. And so that's why I went ahead and challenged him. And then when I got in the ring, I realized that, and this is more than anybody ever would want to know, but, you know, Joe Lewis, when he would step in and hit you with a sidekick, he would take a little stomp step first and then slide in. And you probably know this better than anybody, having received that that sidekick. But I noticed Wallace would do that in his full contact fight, where he wouldn't do that in his point matches. And so I had a plan. My best skill was always distance and timing. So I was going to step inside and hook him. And we have a great picture of where I did that in the first round. I stepped inside the sidekick, and I threw a left hook, and I looked up in the audience in the Omni to see where his head was going to land. And as I did that, he moved his head a little bit, so I missed him by about a half an inch. And so in the rest of the fight, he didn't ever do that again. He just kept trying to pepper me with that front leg, you know, so he could use it like a jab, as you know. And so I just never could get to him after that. He wouldn't make that kind of big commitment anymore. And so it's just that subtle little adaptation, you know, right there, that allowed him to neutralize everybody that he fought.
Well, you know, I'm going to go ahead and I'd like to do the Legends name game with you. And I'm going to shoot you some names that you can talk about, you know, like a fight, 2 or 3 minutes, and just talk from your heart. And I want to start with someone I know that you really love, and he's part of my journey also. I'm talking about Mr. Pat Johnson and his lovely wife, Sue. But Pat Johnson, talk about Pat Johnson.
Well, you know, I mentioned earlier that Chuck had invited me out to California to train, and then, you know, some years went by before I could go out there. And when I went out, he was just so busy doing what he was doing that he gently passed me off to Pat Johnson. So Pat and I immediately hit it off. I mean, he's funny and, you know, so bright. And I mean, he became like my big brother right away. And when I went out there, I had been doing all Korean training, you know, and so I didn't have a left hand punch. If I fought right leg front, I just pawed with my right hand and all that. And so I, as a good student, just tried to pick up everything that I possibly could from him. And then he would, when I would fly up in the air, he would just reach up and grab me out of the air and slam me down on the ground and then punch me. And then if I picked my leg up to try to kick him in the head, he'd be sweeping my supporting leg, and just made me feel really silly. But I went and studied all that and learned how to do those things. And so it was a really interesting relationship. And in my in the book that I'm writing, he is to me what Master Po was to Kwai Cheng Kane. So at the beginning of every chapter, I ask a question to Master Jay. So I'll ask him a question about, you know, the world. Like one question I'm asking is, Master Jay, why is it that we like to go into our past so much and live in these nostalgic moments? And then he'll answer that question, and then we will, in that chapter, you know, do a story about that particular question and answer. So
that is really cool.
He was,
yeah.
And
you know,
if
go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was going to say,
sorry,
if you ever had a chance to see someone teach who was just the best teacher on the planet, it would have been Pat Johnson and Chuck Norris. And Pat would have private students that would train with him for 15, 20, 25, 30 years. And they couldn't get enough of his leadership and mentorship. He would make them feel better about themselves and about their martial arts in a class better than anybody I'd ever seen ever. You know, just incredible.
I love this because I haven't thought about this ever until you started talking about him. I got a good Pat Johnson story. 2006, I'm inducted into the Masters Hall of Fame, and I call Mr. Johnson and I tell him I'm coming, and I tell him about this book that I found, which is from the 16th century, and it has Japanese prints in it, which I'm bringing to the battle this year, and they were actually drawn by samurai. He says, well, is it authentic? So I had it appraised at the Collector's Firearms, and it was authentic, and it was actually drawn by samurai. It's appraised like $10,000. It's actually made out of gold. So I brought these prints to the Masters Hall of Fame. And Mr. Johnson brought this Japanese princess to the ceremony that night and introduced me to her and says, Gary, I brought her here to bless these prints because he had seen them. I sent them to him. And he knew how precious they were. So this princess, she looks at him. And she cries a little bit. She laughs. And then she cries again. And she asked me where I got it. And I explained to her. And she blessed those prints, Mr. Corley. The same ones I'm bringing to the battle this year. I know. Mr. Johnson is an incredible man. And he didn't have to do that, but he did that for me. So God bless him. Let's talk about another gentleman that you talked about earlier. And I want to know how good he was, because I know how good he was. But I know you're personal friends with him. The people that's been remembering him as a movie star, a TV actor. I'm talking about Mr. Chuck Norris. Talk about your friend there.
You know, people ask me all the time, you know, was Chuck Norris really that good? And and I said, yeah, he really was. When I would see him on the floor teaching in California, he had a presence that was just really captivating. And then if you see any of the YouTube videos of him on the screen with anybody from Merv Griffin to you name it, you just see he kind of captivates that audience even more so than he would have in Walker, Texas Ranger or any of those things, because he was a laid-back ranger. But he was very, very ebullient, I think is the word. He would with his charisma, his personality, would just fill up the space. And I didn't get to see a lot of his fighting, but I heard some of the tales. You know, I heard of Fred Wren smacking him in the nose, and then I heard of him repaying Fred Wren with body shots. And I did get to see the fights of him against Joe Louis and with Alan Steen, like I said, on those films that I was watching over and over. And by comparison, the fighting was very basic compared to what we do now, but he was very precise with his movements, very powerful. And he created, you know, what is now the, what people are calling the blitz, you know, and we ended up calling it slide up jab, step forward punch, but where you were able to get your front hand in someone's face and then follow up with that backhand either to the body or to the face. And so those were things that Pat Johnson had passed on to us as we did them. But those were things that were created by Chuck as he went outside the Tang Soo world and gathered some of the things from some of the Shotokan guys out there. So, and then you look at the kind of people that he brought up under him, you know, people from, you know, John Natividad to Bob Burbridge and, you know, Darnell Garcia and all those people. I mean, he was just a great role model for them and helped bring out their best as well.
Well, you know, that's very special. But, you know, for the past 10 years, I've noticed you've had a shadow next to you, and he happens to be a world champion. He's another mentor of mine, a superhero. We're talking about Mr. Jeff W. Smith. Tell me about your relationship with the one and only world champion, Mr. Smith.
Well, it's funny, you know, I guess the second time I went up to Madison Square Garden to fight, I was there by myself, and Jeff and Pat Worley were there together, and I don't know what happened, but somehow they kind of took me under their wing, you know, and Jeff had a Volkswagen van, and so probably one of the scariest rides of my life was getting in that van and riding with Jeff Smith down the streets in New York. He said the lines were not there for any particular reason except to look at, you know, people didn't need to stay in the lanes or anything. He had the, I guess he had taken all the seats out so he could transport whatever he had to transport. And well, I would often accuse him of, he was probably just grabbing people off the street and scaring them to death, riding with him. So he invited me to come up to D.C. to train with him. I still had that Ferrari that I would later sell. So I got in the Ferrari and made it from Atlanta to D.C. in 7.5 hours. I had one of the first radar detectors, and it would be a year later that I would realize that it never worked. I was traveling 145 miles an hour through Virginia to get there. And so got there, and this guy would work out all the time. I mean, he was either doing push-ups or sit-ups or whatever. And I just couldn't do anything with him when I was fighting with him. He was just too strong, and I was weighing, you know, about 165, and he was weighing about 175, but the difference felt like, you know, 50 pounds. And then you'd see him fight people like Everett Eddy in the Battle of Atlanta, and Jeff would be weighing 175, they'd be weighing 235, and Jeff was pushing them around like he was the bigger guy. It's like he didn't realize he was only 175. And so when we started training in kickboxing in Atlanta, he came down and visited, and he enjoyed what we were doing with Asa Gordon down there. And so Asa kind of became his trainer, and Jerry Rome had moved up to D.C., and so he got to spar with Jerry a lot. And he's just a true badass fighter. I mean, I don't know another way to say it. We were kidding about it. When I got ready to fight Wallace there, I was going 12 two-minute rounds in preparation for the nine-round fight with Wallace. I'd fight with Jeff one round, and then Jerry Rome one round, and then Jeff another round, and then Jerry Rome another round. And the newspaper was there to cover it, and the picture they happened to catch was Jeff kicking me in the throat with a round kick. So that one of my least favorite pictures and my least good feelings in my throat.
Well, you mentioned another man that most people, they've forgotten about, but I remember him. He was called Wonder Boy. He was the inventor of Atomix. We're talking about Mr. Barbaro. Tell me about his fighting ability. He was a youngster, right?
He was young. Yeah, I mean, when he was a 17-year-old, he was, I don't know, 6'2", maybe, and, you know, slim, and just could stand up straight and kick everybody in the head. And I think he was an actual mentor in a way for the way Mike Warren fought. And he was just he was I think underappreciated, maybe underrated, and but was just beating everybody up. And he bloodied Joe Lewis's mouth there at the first Battle of Atlanta. You know, just really beautiful round kick in the face. And just good guy, you know, good guy and very, very smart. It was, he was a pleasure to watch.
I've got a couple more. I want to hit you with a gentleman that worked with you in the 70s, Mr. Chris McLaughlin. Tell me about him.
Yeah, Chris was, I don't know, I guess he was maybe a green belt when I was a brown belt, and we used to train together in the same places. And so when our instructor, Kim Dashik, was leaving Atlanta, he asked us if we wanted to buy the school. So Chris went with me and signed a loan for me at the bank, and, you know, so that I could put up my half. And he and I were partners in that venture up through from 1967 through about 1975, and he helped me through through all the schools and through the through the battles of Atlanta. We went together on the, and he was there 70 through 75, and still one of my best friends of all time. And he'll be up here. He's living in Mobile now, but he'll be up here for the Battle of Atlanta in 1 month from today.
Cool, cool. Well, you know, I've got to ask you about two fighters, and I'm going to say them at the same time because I know they fought 20 times. They won 10 each apiece each other. I'm talking about the two of the greatest fighters ever lived, and that's Bobby Tucker and Keith Vitale. Tell me a little bit about them.
Well, if I have the story right, I'm sure Keith will let me know if I did, but I was fighting in a tournament. It was a tournament, I think, that I ended up fighting and luckily winning a fight against Mike Foster here in Atlanta.
Yoshikai, right?
Yeah, that's right. But he came up and fought in that event. And but I think Keith was sitting at ringside as a white belt, and he watched me fight his instructor, whose name was John Roper. And So I won that fight against John Roper, but I obviously wouldn't have known Keith at the time. And then later, when we formed the SEKA, Keith emerged from there, and then it would be 5 years later, 1977, when we would invite Keith to come down to Atlanta to work with us. And so he came to Atlanta and he trained with us. You know, he trained really hard, very smart, very fast. He was with us for a number of years. And during those years, he was ranked number one in the country 3 years in a row. And, won the Battle of Atlanta, and he fought and beat, all the greats. But he and Bobby Tucker, both had been from South Carolina, and I've really heard more about it from Keith than I did see it. But it sounded like they were just the right opponents for each other. They were the kind of guys that would bring out the best in the other one. And it was funny before
story,
Bobby.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, before Bobby came into his own, I was thinking about the things I learned from Pat Johnson. I fought him up at a tournament in North Carolina, and I had learned three different sweeps at the time from Pat Johnson, and I got to use all three of them in the match against Bobby Tucker. And it was he wasn't the fighter that he became later, but in the third one, it was one where he threw a spinning back kick, and I stepped inside and caught him with the general block and then swept his supporting leg. And so he was kind of parallel with the floor on his way to the ground, and he looked up at me and he said, "Not again." And I said, "Yep, one more time." And it was great. He had this great awareness. But then when he really came into his own, he is actually one of the only people to ever beat Mike Warren that I was aware of, and he beat him at the Battle of Atlanta.
Wow, and I've heard so many stories about Mike Warren. All the great fighters always talk about how great Mike Warren was. My favorite story about Bobby and Mr. Vitale was that I don't know what tournament it was. It was probably, I think it was in California. But Bobby just walked up to Keith and says, "You know what? I can tell you how you can beat me." And he sits down and shares with Keith how he can beat him that day. And the fun part about it is, because I know Bobby pretty well from spending time with Sam. Bobby was a hunter and a fisherman, and he just didn't care about the limelight. And Keith didn't really care about the limelight, but he became famous. And there were just two different worlds there. But they were like yin and yang. They really became best friends, and I love talking about them. And I appreciate you sharing that. I got one more guy I want to hit you with, and we lost him a few years back. But he became a friend of mine before we lost him. I'm talking about Harvey Hastings, the writer for Black Belt Magazine. Were you close to him, or did you know him at all?
Yeah, I did, as a matter of fact. Harvey, you may have seen yesterday, is going to be one of our posthumous nominees for the Joe Louis Award.
Well, great guy. But, yeah, he was a great guy.
I first saw Harvey fight a guy named Jack Dutcher up in Ocean City when it was they were going to get in there and do full contact against each other. And up to that point, we had only seen, I guess, Joe Louis against Greg Baines, you know, out there on the West Coast prior to that. And then Harvey got on his bicycle and started riding south, and he rode to Atlanta, and he ended up staying there with us for a number of months. And so he's the first one that really started me doing some boxing and kickboxing kind of things. And then later, when I was going to fight this other fighter, we were going to both pay a promoter $4,990 as an entry fee, and then he was going to throw in $20, I think it was, and then we were going to fight for a $10,000 purse. We didn't like each other, so we were going to fight 15 3-minute rounds, you know, of Muay Thai type fighting. So Harvey arranged it so I could go up and spend some time with Dr. G in Ohio. So I drove up to D.C. first, and I got to train with Jeff and some of his people. And I drove over, and as I drove through, I went to Muhammad Ali's training camp. And on that particular day that I was there, Larry Holmes was in as a sparring partner for Ali. And I got a chance to listen to the Larry Holmes camp outside, you know, talk their trash about how they could really beat Ali and all that. But that was I did that for inspiration. And I drove on over to Dr. G's and got to train out in his outdoor gym, you know, and hit, you know, the really canvas covered real sandbag, you know, and then came back to Atlanta and continued training. And it was about that time that we found Asa Gordon and, started working with him, and his boxers started hitting me with punches that allowed me to see things behind me that my head really couldn't turn to see. But because they accelerated my head so fast with their hooks, I was actually able to see stuff, you know, maybe 270 degrees around from the front. And then, like I said earlier, Jeff Smith came down and trained with him. We just had so many good people that came in from around the country. Asa Gordon made such a great contribution. But Harvey was always a free spirit. And we were just talking about him today with Jack Ballard, who had earned his 7th degree under Harvey before Harvey passed away.
Yeah, he was very, in the early years of the museum, he helped me a lot and talked to me a lot, and he gave me a lot of guidance, a lot of contacts. But you mentioned someone else that I've got to share with you. I didn't get to share with this at the pre-interview, but, you know, Dr. Manji, he's actually Garrett's godfather. He actually...
No kidding.
Asked, I wanted to share that with you, but I'm so glad I get to share this with you now. You remember the black cane that's filled with sand? They carried everywhere with him in the early years? And the black bamboo cane. Yes. We performed at Bushy Bond, and that, you know, that's the combination of Zufi Ahmed with Okinawa Karate and Bando. And he saw Garrett, fell in love with him. And Garrett, I just left Garrett with him for years. And then, of course, Garrett got his black belt and everything. And one day, Dr. G came up to me and said, I want to bless Garrett. I want to become his godfather. And
wow.
After that day, yes, from that day on, from I guess he was 9, Mr. G has been a big part of his life and my life too. So it's a small world, Mr. Corley. God bless you. And I know that, you know, that you're very close to Dr. G. In fact, I saw where he's up for one of the Eternal Warrior Awards. Is he going to be able to make it? I know he's living in Georgia, correct? In a home someplace?
Yeah, he's down in that part of the city where they're doing all of the filming now. I talked to his wife the other day. She said that he's having a hard time being mobile right now, so they're going to send somebody, but that whoever they send is going to receive the award, not only for Dr. G, but for Harvey Hastings and Bob Maxwell.
Very well. Bob Maxwell, good guy, but yeah, it would be very emotional. Because Garrett's fighting this year, you know. He's going in there with Willie Hicks and Regina. And he saw Dr. G's name on the induction list, and he just got down and started crying because Dr. G is a big part of our lives. You know, you've been a big part of my life, and you're one of the original history generals for the Sport Karate Museum archives. How important is it that sport karate history is kept, and all the work that you've done and the work that I've done, and we keep doing this way after the 50th anniversary, way after, you know, the legends? I mean, how important is it, Mr. Coy?
Well, you know, I'm probably not the right person to ask that question because I'm a concerned citizen about, you know, what is happening in America. But having said that, I think that if in the schools we could have a shift kind of back to the right, and that shift would include, you know, the tenets, if you will, of what attracted most of us to martial arts in the beginning. You know, this desire to have manly men and womanly women, you know, that could show us the way, you know, teach us the way, because what really inspires most of us is a great feeling that we know that changed our lives, and we've wanted to share that feeling with other people, and we really get a lot from that giving. I think if we could somehow find the way in the martial arts and other parts of our culture to instill in the young people the good things that we found in the martial arts, that having the museum and those parts of the history that you're talking about would be great to layer onto their education so they could have an appreciation for what went before. But with today's social media and the living in the fantasy worlds that we so often see kids living in, it's hard to see how we can make that connection with them. But just like in this last election, there were enough people that didn't want to see the world go in a certain direction. Hopefully, in this meeting that we're having here in Atlanta 1 month from today, we can have something come out of that would even underscore the importance of the History Museum and help all of us to focus on the question that you just asked.
Well, how important is sport in America has its own life, as you know. We talked about for the past 2 hours the people, the icons, the people that you're personal friends with. How important is those guys' memories are remembered? You know, we talked about people either forgotten about or don't remember.
Well, you know, it's back to my question of Master Jay. Master Jay, why do we want to?
Yes, sir.
Why do we want to thrive on these things that are nostalgic? My daughter is 20, and I don't think she understands a whit about why I'm excited about, you know, a Battle of Atlanta. You know, she likes to come and hang with her friends and all that. So I don't know if my pay grade is quite high enough to really understand the correct answer to the question. I know when I was a young black belt that I was inspired by watching these others, and I think we have the potential for that in our sport. I just think that it's nothing bad about the martial arts that's caused it. It's a whole shift in the culture, you know. When you think about how you could train kids, for example, when the first Karate Kid came out in 1983 or 84, and then you think about how different that became after Al Gore invented the internet, right?
Yes.
And then you think about every 5 years after that, and then how it accelerated once Steve Jobs had the iPhone and have all the video games and all the things that are going on now. And you think about you just think about the big shift that's happened inside the martial arts school. How do you get young people's attention focused on the history? What is it? You know, it's almost like it has to be something that they can do in their phone. Can we turn the History Museum into an app, a game, you know?
Of course, and you know what? It's funny you said that. That's in the works of creating portals.
Good.
And creating a video game, and that's something we can talk about in our many phone calls that we have. Well, it's been an enjoyable show. This is my first 2-hour broadcast after 2 years, and I'm proud to say I've done it with the one and only legendary Joe Corley. And with that said, Mr. Corley, what would you like to say to my listeners as a goodbye statement for the Battle of Alana?
Well, I just invite any of the people that have an appreciation for the things that you've been talking about to join us and get a chance to come and meet and talk firsthand with people. I've had people like Ernest Hart as an example say to me that when I was at a tournament in St. Louis, he had read about me in the magazine, and he came up to me as a teenage kid, and you know, he thought I was just gonna kind of shrug him off, and that I answered his question, and I was polite to him and engaging, and just the way you described Pat Johnson, you know, out there, and that if we could encourage the instructors to have their students come and just give them a little history lesson through the martial arts magazines they've got on the kind of people that they'll meet in Atlanta, to come and ask them questions and see if it doesn't change a life. I said to Ernest Hart, for example, go get Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill, and then to know that at some point in time he did that, and then called me and said, I can't believe how that's changed my life, you know, how it changes my whole perspective. So if they can get some wisdom from some of these people, I think it would be a way to help inspire the next generation. And that's really, you know, we're calling it, Gary, the gathering of world changers. And that's what I really believe they were, is world changers. So the question a lot of us ask ourselves is, who's going to be the next generation of these world changers? What have we done to sow that ground to make sure there is another great generation?
Well, I'm really looking forward to spending time with my friends and the people I've worked with for 20 years, and also to have my little table to display my little Sport Karate Museum stuff. But God bless you, Mr. Corley, for spending time with me. I feel I'm the luckiest Hawaii boy that left the islands, and talking for Mr. Nantitahad and Mike Stone, and of course Mr. Parker, rest in peace, and all the other Hawaiians. We love you, sir, and thank you for your time tonight. I thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
And
thank you, and thanks for the great and the insightful questions.
Thank you, sir. God bless you. Well, on behalf of Mr.
Yes,
Joe Corley, the creator of The Battle of Alana, what a special show we've had tonight. We'll be here next Tuesday night with three ladies, one from the West Coast, Ms. Sharon Wong, one of the top fighters in California, Ms. Jennifer Branch, one of the top fighters in Texas, and Karen Slatcher from the East Coast. So join us next week for the AMMA Masters Radio Network, and we'll be talking to some of the top women in martial arts. On behalf of Jesse Bowen and the AMA Masters Network, this is Professor Gary Lee. Mahalo. Good night. Aloha.